you've got a big day. So you use Unstoppable Scent Boosters to give your laundry non-stop freshness. So no matter how long the day goes, you
can't stop this power, this walk, this pose, this strut, this look, this talk.
Your clothes will be so fresh you can confidently strut into that end-of-the-day meeting like a
boss, 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 bosses. Let's talk business in my office.
Add new Unstoppables beads to your wash for 24-hour non-stop freshness so you can smell unstoppable.
Good morning. Jane Pauley is off this weekend. I'm Mo Rocca, and this is Sunday Morning. For many seniors, access to health care, transportation, even companionship becomes more difficult over time. That's especially true for seniors living in rural areas where public resources are often limited. This morning, Lee Cowan will take us to North Dakota, where one program is proving that neighbors can make all the difference.
For those getting older in a small rural town.
Thank you, Linda. Do you want help with this?
The idea of moving closer to anything means moving farther away from everything they know.
Good to see ya.
You too. You have time for a little visit?
An idea that seems like common sense.
Hi, how are you?
But has found good. Its way into practice. Gosh, ahead on Sunday morning.
Nice morning today.
When Lauren Hutton signed an exclusive $250,000 contract with Revlon in 1973, she became the highest paid model in history, transforming the economics of the business and becoming a household name in the process. At 82, the fashion icon is reflecting on her remarkable life and career with Anthony Mason.
You never really wanted to be a model.
Never heard of it.
With her gap-toothed smile, Lauren Hutton was told she'd never be a cover girl, but she became one.
I was not there to see myself on the stands. I was there to get the money to go see the world.
And she has. The adventures of Lauren Hutton, the original supermodel.
You moved here in 1964?
Yes.
Coming up on Sunday Morning.
As America marks its 250th birthday, we'll be looking back at a Revolutionary War hero whose name once rang out across these United States, and still does if you know where to look. The Revolutionary War drew freedom fighters the world over, including the Polish-born military engineer Thaddeus Kosciuszko.
Kosciuszko was responsible for the turning point of the American Revolution.
Later on Sunday Morning, the patriot with the tongue-twisting name who was key to America's victory. With the Cyclospora outbreak having dominated the headlines this past week, David Pogue this morning asks, just how safe is our food? Seth Doan catches up with English singer-songwriter Corinne Bailey Ray 20 years after this song. Became an international hit. Plus, Connor Knighton explains worm grunting. And more on this final Sunday morning of the month, July 26th, 2026. We'll be right back. Aging at home isn't easy for anyone, and in isolated parts of rural America, it can be even harder. Lee Cowan takes us to North Dakota to see those challenges firsthand and introduce us to an organization bringing neighbors together to support one another.
Salem Sioux has stood proudly on this lonely bluff, defiant against the sometimes merciless weather of the North Dakota plains, for more than 50 years. And for all those years, she's looked out over small farming towns like Hebron and Glen Ullin, which have also withstood all manner of aging challenges themselves.
Mainly retired people, you know, most of it, I'd say.
Despite the difficulties, 98-year-old Mae Buckley, whom we met back in 2025, is determined to live out her days out here.
We decided we're not going to move because we want to stay by home. You know how that is.
Across the country, rural America is growing older faster than urban America. According to the USDA, the number of counties where at least 20% of residents are over the age of 65 has nearly tripled since 2010.
Thank you, Linda. Do you want help with this?
And it's in those older populations where the health risks associated with loneliness and social isolation are more common.
Sundays are the worst because there's nothing going on.
Yeah.
88-year-old Linda Horoff knows no other life, nor does she want another one.
It's so opposite to these little rural towns from cities and things.
But it sounds like you wouldn't head any other way.
No, I wouldn't. I absolutely wouldn't.
For Father Gary Bentz, this is well-worn territory.
And I grew up on a farm about 12 miles from there.
Hello, Viola.
If his parishioners can't come to him, he goes to them. First of all, like 96-year-old Viola Weinhardt.
Okay, we'll pray together in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
How do you think it's changed your personal ministry?
You know, it's helped me because I think it's made me more compassionate because my parents were in their situation. And so I know firsthand how lonely life can be. How many were in your family? 10?
He spends a little time with me each week then and fills me in on the latest, and especially in church. He's good company.
Yeah.
In rural counties, one in five adults is age 65 or older. Even if some wanted to move to more urban areas with more resources, the cost disparity would make it difficult at best. The Rural Health Transformation Program, part of President Trump's Big Beautiful Bill, is pouring $50 billion into providing better access for seniors to doctors and other caregivers. But there are still cracks that seniors can fall through, and they aren't always about medicine.
Sometimes older adults, especially during the challenging years, sometimes get overlooked, forgotten.
Jane Strawman is a gerontology specialist at North Dakota State University Extension in Fargo, who's been taking more of a grassroots approach to helping rural seniors.
People are good, and they want to help their fellow neighbor and community member. Sometimes it just takes a little bit of organizing. How can we do that?
Watch your step.
Acting as our brother's or sister's keeper may sound pretty naive.
Yep, see you next month.
Call me, yeah, call me.
But not to the Margaret A. Cargill Philanthropies, which funded a local pilot program directed by Strowman called Aging in Community.
We're trying to keep it practical and keep it simple and something that's workable in our rural communities.
It essentially takes what is already there, neighbors.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
And encourages them to form a kind of neighborhood watch for seniors.
I'll pick up ice cream, and I've already got plates and forks.
Kyla Sanders, a retired nurse who grew up in rural Montana, has been on board since the beginning.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Good.
Good to see ya.
She's one of four regional coordinators for Aging in Community.
The time is.
On this day, we watched her bring Mae Buckley a calendar that she can hear, not see.
March 12th, Wednesday.
Oh, is that ever neat?
I think it's kind of nice. And
oh, my gosh.
Just a little assistance that mattered more than you might know.
They want to be able to be around other humans and interact and have that sense of belonging and that sense of value.
She spends hours taking the roads less traveled out here.
How about if I take this back to my office?
Okay.
And I will bring it to you Wednesday. We're going to be here to put it.
She helps with everything from stopped wristwatches to filing tax returns.
All right, TV title with blue, so you're first over here.
And she's organized game days, like this one.
Yay! There you go.
She's been working for Aging in Community for 5 years now, and in that time, The NDSU extension program has been able to do what no federal health care plan can necessarily provide.
Our clients are saying that they have a higher quality of life, that they feel more confident living at home, that they feel more connected to resources locally. Those are three really big things for us.
Here we go.
So big, the program is expanding to serve 12 North Dakota counties. Some of them so rural, they're classified as frontier, meaning there are six or fewer people per square mile.
All right, well, I'm going to take off, but we'll see you this afternoon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Back at Linda Horoff's house, our visit extended long after Kyla left. Yes. Pleasantly so.
Do you use something in your coffee?
A little cream would be great.
Ooh.
Where we talked might have mattered more than what we talked about. After all, as Linda and so many others told us,
there's no place like home.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah, it's okay.
Latte for Keenan?
That's me.
Hey, you're...
Yeah.
Buying a car online on AutoTrader?
Really? But unlike other sites, you can start online, test drive with a local dealer, then finish online or at the dealership.
Cool. Enjoy.
Buy your car online on AutoTrader. Really.
And we begin with that massive parasite outbreak.
The cyclospora outbreak expanding across the country.
With the FDA reporting that contaminated lettuce has sickened people nationwide, once again, we're confronting the question... How safe is our food? And as David Pogue now tells us, it's complicated.
This tiny microbe has been making a lot of Americans sick. Really sick. Just ask Jessica Mallard.
I wasn't feeling well. The pain in my stomach was like unbearable.
The parasite is called Cyclospora. It gives you, and I'm sorry to have to say this, debilitating explosive diarrhea that can last for weeks. Since May, more than 11,000 cases of this miserable illness have been reported in 41 states.
I'm still fatigued. I'm really, really weak.
The FDA believes that the biggest outbreak this season, the one affecting 9 states so far, came to us aboard contaminated iceberg lettuce from Mexico. That lettuce was shipped nationwide by Taylor Farms, a huge distributor that supplies thousands of groceries and restaurants.
We've never seen anything like this. This is just an astonishingly large outbreak, record-setting outbreak.
Susan Main is an adjunct professor at the Yale School of Public Health. She ran the Food Safety Department of the FDA from 2015 to 2023.
Cyclospora comes from human feces. So how did that get on the lettuce?
It could be inadequate bathroom facilities, inadequate hand washing facilities. Somehow that water is getting contaminated from some other source, sewage, some other source.
Almost half of all foodborne illnesses come from fruits and vegetables, in part because we usually don't cook them before eating. These outbreaks are financially devastating to farmers, suppliers, and restaurants. And so, after a 2006 spinach contamination, the West Coast farming industry resolved to self-regulate.
FDA said, do not eat spinach, right? And that literally affected every grower, provider of spinach in the country. So California said, we need to do something from a food safety standpoint.
The Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement was born, a coalition of farmers who've agreed to adopt food safety protocols more stringent than the government's.
Everybody.
We met CEO Tim York last year.
They join voluntarily, but once they join, they must follow our rules.
We have to do it. You know, any kind of outbreak is detrimental to our industry.
Jack Vesey is a fourth-generation produce farmer who works by the LGMA's rules, sanitizing the irrigation water, testing it at the source and at the spraying end, hair nets and gloves, knife disinfectant,
traceability's purposes,
state inspections at least 3 times a year, barcodes for tracing produce back to their originating fields.
If my dad was here today, he'd probably think, oh my gosh, what are you guys doing now?
All right, so despite all of this, outbreaks still happen. So why are they still happening?
Outbreaks may occur because we are growing product outdoors. You know, some bacteria just occur naturally within an environment. They just exist. And so we control as much of the ecosystem as we can.
Eventually, every discussion of food safety rolls around to the government.
As I understand it, the budgets for food safety have been whittling down for multiple presidents.
That is accurate. Food safety in the U.S. has been under-resourced for decades.
In President Trump's second term, the FDA has lost about 20% of its staff. The CDC is down 25%. The CDC used to have 11 scientists tracking food parasites. Now it's three.
We had a national advisory committee, a committee that advised FDA and USDA on how to prevent microbial contamination in food. That advisory committee was disbanded. We used to convene meetings with our Mexican counterparts on how we can work together to improve food safety. That entire team was let go.
And then there's FoodNet, a joint venture of the FDA, the CDC, and the USDA, an early warning surveillance program that used to track 8 particularly nasty microbes. But now it tracks only 2.
Encyclospora is not one of them?
That's correct.
In 2011, Congress passed a food safety bill that included a traceability rule. It said that any food-related company must keep detailed supply chain records for vulnerable ingredients all the way from the fields to the store. It was supposed to take effect this year.
So I can tell you, having seen lettuce tracebacks, that would have been incredibly helpful.
But Congress has delayed the rule until 2028.
So next summer's cyclospora outbreaks, we still won't be able to trace them.
That's correct. Unless Congress or somebody else intervenes in the interim.
This past week, Health and Human Services Director Robert F. Kennedy Jr. spoke to reporters.
Those criticisms are invalid. We've had no cuts in our surveillance program. We did cuts in the FoodNet program, but they were for redundant surveillance.
Is that accurate?
No, it's not accurate. I mean, clearly there have been cuts.
So for now, then, what would be your advice for consumers?
For now, I would avoid the bagged salads. And the reason is that a little bit of contamination can be spread more broadly through bagged salads.
According to former FDA food safety head Susan Main, this summer's outbreaks are more than just another headline.
This is a national wake-up call. We want our dollars to be spent protecting public health and protecting health. And so I hope people will make that message clear, because I haven't talked to a single person from either party that wants to see unsafe food on our tables.
Some 20 years after Corinne Bailey Rae burst onto the international music scene with that hit song, her signature tune remains a modern classic. This morning with Seth Doan, she has a summer song.
All right, and the Grammy goes to Corinne Bailey Rae, Is This Love?
Is this love? Is this love that I'm feeling?
Before winning 2 Grammys and being nominated for 4 others.
So this is where I used to work.
Working the coat check.
Yeah, this is a half dozen. Are you like, you're in your little box?
Was about as close as Corinne Bailey Rae was getting to a stage.
And I really always wanted to see the bands. So being here wasn't great because you couldn't see exactly what was, you could hear it. So the stage would come out to about here.
And it was here at the Hi-Fi Club in her native Leeds in England where a record label would later come to hear her in an audition.
When I did Like a Star, I did it just on my own with a guitarist.
Just like a star across my sky.
Like a Star, her first single, became a hit.
You have appeared to my life.
As did her second, Put Your Records On. Its lyrics, music facilitating self-acceptance, have autobiographical notes.
As much as Leeds is a really ethnically diverse place, you can still feel different as a person who has,
you know, a black parent and a white parent.
She says growing up, she sometimes felt on the margins.
I really wanted to play the cello, but we didn't have a car. So my mom was like, oh, what about the, you know, the mini, the one you can carry? So I ended up playing the violin and I really enjoyed that.
Did you realize that resources were an issue growing up?
I sort of noticed things like that, like, oh, we didn't have a car, oh, we don't have a telephone. We didn't have a lot of money, but it wasn't a sad thing.
When did you go from playing the violin in school to realizing, oh, I have a voice too?
Well, I always loved singing, but I always felt so sad about my voice because it had all this texture. 'Cause the blues
ain't never. That changed when she heard the voices of Billie Holiday and Kurt Cobain.
It was like, you are welcome in this space. Their songs don't necessarily have to be, you know, shiny and perfect. And that just made me feel like I could be in music.
The release of her first album in 2006 catapulted her to the top of the charts and into new company.
Stevie Wonder called me, you know, Prince came to one of our shows.
But in 2008, everything changed when her husband and band member Jason Ray died of an accidental overdose.
It felt at that time to be the sort of end of my life.
And you're thinking what?
I almost wasn't thinking anything. It was just like such a huge amount of pain.
How did you deal with your grief?
I say a thing that someone said to me in the hospital. She said, oh, grief is a long journey. We're all gonna lose people, you know? If we're lucky to have a long life, we're just gonna see like people just going, you know, through that door. And there's something really, you know, beautiful about knowing that. Sorry.
You still get emotional.
I think it's such a complex emotion because it's sort of like the sadness of losing someone, but also the awareness of how beautiful, you know, life is and how it's a beautiful thing that everyone you know, you have that much time with them, you know.
There was nothing from Corinne Bailey Ray for about 2 years until amid the grief of losing Jason, she released her second album, The Sea. It was produced by Steve Brown, who'd always just been a professional collaborator.
Actually, Jason's mother, who first said to me, you know, what do you think of Steve?
Really?
Yes.
She was the matchmaker?
She is just a really intuitive woman. I felt it was two things. One was, I like this guy. But another thing was sort of like, we as the family kind of give you permission to, you know, move forward with your life, which I just thought was a very beautiful thing of her to do.
What a gift.
Yeah, she's amazing.
The couple married in 2013 and now have two daughters.
It was like having a second chance. So I do think of my life as having these two, kind of like a before and after. He come riding
in on a red horse. Bailey Ray released two more studio albums to critical acclaim, if not all-out commercial success. And she's been recognized in her hometown.
This is a beautiful sculpture that came up a few years ago, and it has more than 300 names of women who are from Leeds who've made an impact in culture. So some suffragettes, some politicians, some artists, you know.
And you.
And me, I am on there, yes.
Earlier this year, she released a children's book, the title recalling her chart-topping song.
I wanted to write about how music can heal you, that music can sit with you in any emotion, how music can be your friend.
The book is part of a year-long celebration of her first album. There's also a tour, which she was kicking off at Cheltenham Jazz Festival in England. Singing those hits from 20 years ago that first made her famous.
Is it a weight in some ways to have a song be that successful? Do you feel like you're chasing something that you got with that song?
I think when someone does really well, everyone wants you to kind of win in that particular way again. You know, the music industry is really brutal. They really want you to be commercially successful.
How about you?
I mean,
commercial success must feel good.
Yeah, definitely. But it was funny with that first record, I wasn't thinking like, oh, this is going to be, like, I had no idea that it was going to be successful in that way. We made it in a basement studio with no windows. So it wasn't like I went in with a certain kind of ambition. I just wanted to make the songs work.
Just go ahead and let your head down. You're gonna find your way somewhere.
It seems like rebirth in a way is a theme.
Rebirth is a really big theme for me, and there's a possibility every single time of starting again, you know, at any age, in any space, you can sort of hit reset and do it again and go back into the fire, transform and be out as a new thing, you know, every single time.
Somehow.
Best thing that's ever happened to you financially. Go.
Easy. Sold my car on Carvana. Amazing offer.
Really? I hit 200 on the scratcher.
Did the scratcher come to your house and hand you a check?
No.
How many scratchers did you hit to get that? I hit a button on Carvana.com once.
Okay, that's fair.
It's like the lottery, except you always win.
Not like the lottery at all, actually.
Exactly. Inexplicably good. Offers worth bragging about. Sell your car today on Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
He was called the Host Whisperer. During his half century in television, Peter LaSalle, who died last Sunday, played producer and confidant to late night hosts Craig Ferguson, Tom Snyder, David Letterman, and The Tonight Show's Johnny Carson.
Johnny Carson, which I think will surprise you, was the shyest man I've ever dealt with.
As he told me in 2018, LaSalle also helped break in some of The Tonight Show guest hosts.
Kermit the Frog did it once, and it was magical. I loved it, I loved it, I loved it.
But Peter LaSalle's life before television was no laughing matter. He was born in Germany in 1932. Jewish, the family fled to Holland, where LaSalle's older sister was classmates with Anne Frank.
I mean, all her experiences were not unusual or strange to me. I mean, you hid from the Nazis the best way you could, and we tried and failed.
At age 11, Peter and his sister and mother were sent to the first of two concentration camps. The three survived and came to America in 1947, where LaSalle met the love of his life, Alice, to whom he was married for 60 years.
What do you see when you look at that, other than a very handsome man?
I see great lighting and a great performance.
What I see is, I mean, a little bit of wariness, a guy who's seen a lot.
I saw a lot. You're right about that. I saw plenty.
Peter LaSalle was 93. Our look at America at 250 continues this morning with the story of a revolutionary hero whose name may not be familiar. But if you look around these United States, he's certainly not been forgotten. No surprise there are more memorials in the U.S. to George Washington than of any other hero of the Revolutionary War. But close on his heels? You guessed it, Polish-born military engineer Thaddeus Kosciuszko.
Across the street from the White House, in Chicago by Soldier Field, there's one in St. Petersburg, Florida. There's one in Philadelphia. There's one in Boston. Every town that had Polish Americans in it put up a statue to their national hero.
And it's not just statues. Oprah Winfrey's Mississippi hometown? even a heavily trafficked, if often mispronounced, bridge in New York City.
And then not doing more than 25 miles an hour as you approach the Kosciuszko.
Which is where journalist Alex Storozynski often heard his name.
When I was growing up, they'd say, that's traffic on the Kosciuszko Bridge. And I kept calling up all these radio stations and saying, no, it's Kosciuszko.
It's actually not that hard to say.
The first syllable is cuz, like the word cousin. The second one is choose, like choose or lose. Cuz, choose, co.
You made this so easy. Kosciuszko.
Kosciuszko, there you go.
Kosciuszko. I think he's got it. But now, this was a name that was once very well known in this country, yes?
He was very well known in this country.
Storozynski should know. He wrote a book about Kosciuszko, an immigrant who became key to the colonists' victory over the crown, arriving from Poland just weeks after the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
He gets to Philadelphia, and he walks into Benjamin Franklin's print shop.
Does he speak a lick of English?
No, but Benjamin Franklin spoke French. And he said, I want to take your test for military engineering. And Benjamin Franklin says, our test for what?
This is really a startup, this revolution.
The whole country was a startup at that point.
Right.
After designing fortifications to protect the city of brotherly love, Kosciuszko went on to distinguish himself in the field of battle, crucially at Saratoga, where his plans are credited with turning the tide of the war in favor of the Patriots and attracting the attention of the Army's commanding general, George Washington. The two would first meet a few months later, 60 miles north of New York City, at a strategic outpost known as West Point.
Initially, George Washington thought Kosciuszko was French, and he kept inquiring about him in letters, writing to other officers, and he spelled his name 11 different ways. And when he finally met Kosciuszko in West Point, he said, wow, this guy knows what he's doing. So he learned how to spell his name properly, he learned how to pronounce it properly.
George Washington called West Point the key to the continent.
Because if you control this river...
You control this river, then you control water access all the way from New York City to Quebec in Canada.
So if the British control that river, the rebellion in New England is cut off.
It's cut off completely.
Colonel Sean Scully is a professor of history at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He says that by the time Kosciuszko arrived here in April of 1778, Patriot forces had in place a rudimentary mechanism to keep the Hudson out of the hands of the British. A massive iron chain that would be stretched across the river to deter boats from crossing.
This had to be strong to stop a warship.
We're not sure if they rammed it, if it would actually have held, but it doesn't matter because no British captain is going to risk one of His Majesty's vessels by testing it out.
But to protect that chain, Kosciuszko, who understood the importance of defending from higher ground, engineered a series of forts perched above the water. A plan so sophisticated for the time, Benedict Arnold tried to sell it to the British in an act of treason that would forever define his name. Fortunately, Arnold failed and the revolution succeeded, and Thaddeus Kosciuszko took his place in the history books, alongside other immigrant heroes who'd come to the colonists' aid.
It's striking to me how much of a magnet all over the world the American Revolution was.
It starts all the other revolutions. And I think, in part, that's because the philosophy that underlines the revolution that's stated in the Declaration of Independence is so aspirational that power comes from the people, not from a king. It states that all men are created equal, that they have certain inalienable rights, and that those rights are what governments are created to protect. All of this is new.
In his will, Kosciuszko directed that the money he made during the war be used to purchase the freedom of enslaved Americans, including those owned by his friend Thomas Jefferson. That plan never came to fruition.
And he was also very humble.
Alex Storozynski believes Thaddeus Kosciuszko's name deserves to be better known to Americans, even if they have a hard time pronouncing it.
He truly believed in freedom for all. I mean, that's truly beautiful.
With a story certain to worm its way into your heart, here's Connor Knighton.
The early bird gets the worm. That's why, just before sunrise, Gary Revel is wandering through the woods near Sop Choppy, Florida, to stake out the perfect spot. He pounds a piece of wood, known as a stob, into a promising patch of soil and gets to work. After a few minutes of rubbing the top with a flat piece of iron, earthworms begin to emerge from the earth, where Revel's wife Audrey is waiting to snatch them up.
Let me see your haul here.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Got a can full there.
So is this a good morning so far?
Oh yeah, great morning.
Back at home, they'll clean and process the worms to sell as live bait. Those who buy them to catch fish may never know how their worm was caught.
A lot of people think we dig them up.
Well, honestly, between the two choices, digging sounds a lot more logical than doing some sort of magic trick that summons them to the surface.
Magic's the best. It's like a musical instrument. It's got to be played by the guy that owns it. He knows what he needs to do with it.
It's a process known as worm grunting, and this part of Northwest Florida has been a hot spot for more than a century.
Okay. Oh, that's a good, that's what we want, all right.
That deer's going right here.
Is it work? All right, hey buddy.
Get it.
Yep, come on, wake up. Wake up, worms.
For a long time, worm grunting really did feel like magic. Nobody was quite sure why this worked.
We never give it that much thought.
Really?
Yeah, we was always interested in going fishing. We'd hurry up and get the worms. We didn't care what was going on.
Why it works, you just know it does work.
We gotta get to the water, you know. Yeah.
In 2008, a Vanderbilt University study finally demonstrated that southeastern Diplocardia earthworms most likely perceive the vibrations to be a worm-eating mole digging toward them. And 99 times out of 100, the escaping worms would be right. But then, every once in a while,
they go, whoa, here comes the big mole.
And instead they come up to the surface and find
That's right, yeah. And they try to get out of the way of me. But some of them do, most of them don't.
Revel grew up worm grunting for fun, then turned pro. While he only works part-time these days, he gets around $20 a bucket. Worm grunting was once a real business around these parts, as our very own Charles Carroll discovered in 1972.
The casual passerby through Sop Choppy, Florida, watching Jim Rozier at his daily occupation, would surely think he'd taken leave of his senses. But no, he's just doing what a lot of people do around Sop Choppy, grunting for worms.
It was possible to work as a full-time worm grunter.
Can people actually make a living at this?
I do.
But not long after Carroll stopped by, soft plastic fishing lures started to lure many people away from using live bait. The local worm industry declined, but by then, Sop Choppy had been given a brand.
Yes, worm grunt time down low, Sop Choppy. Can't sing a song but the melody.
For the past 26 years, Sop Choppy has hosted a worm grunting festival. It's an excuse for the small town to throw a big party, celebrating its favorite invertebrate. There's a wiggle fun run, a gummy worm eating contest, a worm queen is crowned, and children get to give grunting a try.
We gotta bring the true legend out. Mr. Gary, come out here and show him how it's really done. I'll give it up for the legend.
If you can inspire some of them kids to learn that maybe an office job ain't what I need, then not say worming, they might take up something like archaeology or some kind of outside occupation.
Revel, who's 74, has taught his son Snap to grunt, but he knows there's not a new generation of professional grunters coming up.
Me and Audrey and Snap's one of the last families that does this, the whole process. And when we're done, that's it.
But Revel isn't planning on stopping anytime soon. For him, spending time in the woods with the worms is a way of life.
All your worries will go away. And it seems to be fun and the thing to do if you live in the woods.
That doesn't get old for you?
No. No, I got to go out there and see what them worms is up to.
You wake up curious.
Yeah, I ain't going to forget about them, not overnight either.
By pretty much any measure, model and actor Lauren Hutton is truly a trailblazer. And yet to hear her tell it, she was just born lucky. Whatever the explanation, she's one of the most recognizable faces of her generation. And she's talking with Anthony Mason.
In this photograph, we actually see the gap in your teeth. But in the beginning, they didn't want you to show it.
No. And I had to buy a little $300 plastic thing that went there that I would sneeze out and lose.
Lauren Hutton was told again and again in the 1960s that she wasn't cut out to be a model.
You've got that space between your teeth. Your eyes are crossed a lot of the times. And I had improper everything.
She still owns the record for most cover appearances on American Vogue, 26. And at 82, she still has that smile.
How do you feel about basically having been the first supermodel?
Yeah, certainly it was about money, and I changed the whole money system.
Lauren's not nine anymore.
In 1973, Revlon signed her to an exclusive deal for $250,000 a year.
It's a whole lot better than natural.
Then the biggest contract in modeling history.
You moved here in 1964?
Yes.
Coming from college in New Orleans, she saw New York as a gateway to the world and the wild places she wanted to visit. Ask her about modeling, and somehow you'll almost always end up in Africa.
But I lived with pygmies, and I lived with Carol Mojong, and I lived with Kalahari Bushmen. You're constantly excited. You're constantly thrilled. And everything's beautiful. My life was none of this stuff. My life was traveling.
Right.
That's the only reason I came to New York.
You never really wanted to be a model.
Never heard of it.
In so many ways, it was all an accident.
Amen. Amen. I've always been lucky.
Yeah.
I was born lucky.
She was born Mary Lawrence Hutton in Charleston, South Carolina, during World War II. Her dad was an Army pilot overseas.
He wrote me every single day from the war. And my mother very kindly and beautifully put it into books for me.
Her parents split in 1945. She grew up in Florida with an abusive stepfather, so she treasured her father's letters.
Because I wanted my daddy bad.
But you never met him.
No. But he gave me enough love in those letters that held me all this time and made me love men. I mean, you guys are something else.
My name is Lulu Porter.
Hutton made her screen debut in 1963 as a decoy contestant on To Tell the Truth.
You're number two, you got a vote. What is your real name and what do you do?
Oh, my name is Lauren Hutton and I'm a bunny at the New York Playboy Club.
You were actually, in the beginning, turned down by, what, four different modeling agencies?
Yeah, well, no, I was turned down by five.
Eileen Ford, who'd call Hutton a believable beauty, finally gave her a shot, later admitting, I still don't know what made me take her.
Tell me about meeting Diana Vreeland.
Ah, heaven.
Hutton was sent to see the legendary editor of Vogue.
And she said, you! And I looked, and she had pointed this long, beautiful finger at me. And she said, you have quite a presence. I had no idea what that was. What was a presence? And, but I took a chance, and I said, well, you sure do.
Vreeland quickly connected her with one of Vogue's top photographers.
She said, I'm calling Dick.
Avedon.
That's what she meant. There was only one. And we made wonderful, they're still some of the best pictures I ever took.
Avedon and Hutton became frequent collaborators.
Ow! I can't stand this, Dick!
Lauren, that's fantastic.
Soon, she was the hottest model in the country and a household name.
Natural, shining, free. Just the real natural me. I think that's pretty nice.
Liquid Prel for naturally beautiful hair.
The light bulb is great.
We met Hutton at the Rauschenberg Foundation, the studio of the late artist Robert Rauschenberg.
I always feel easy and comfortable when I'm around his pictures because that's what he was.
A friend and neighbor, Rauschenberg created this collage portrait of her.
I finally decided she was a goddess.
Yes, she is.
Which I identified with her.
Hold it!
Hutton landed film roles, too. In Paper Lion with Alan Alda.
Shoot him, shoot him, shoot him, right, shoot him!
The Gambler with James Caan.
How many languages do you speak?
And American Gigolo with Richard Gere.
Plus the international language.
That's right.
For someone who didn't want to be a model.
Or an actress.
You turn out to be really good at it, and you seem to not only understand to do it, but you seem to figure out the economics of it.
Twice. I did that twice. Because Bob lost all the first bunch.
Bob was Bob Williamson. For nearly three decades, her boyfriend, father figure, and financial manager.
You'd hear all these girls say, my sweetheart's in high finance. What is yours in? I'd say low finance. And I was right.
They traveled the world together until she discovered he'd lost nearly $13 million of her money.
Bob was very, very smart about all kinds of stuff.
But he also lost all your money.
Yeah, but you know what? I'd do it again in a second like that.
You wouldn't trade everything you got with him?
No.
She went back to fashion and earned her fortune all over again.
I just kept on plugging.
Resilience is a recurring theme in Hutton's life. In 2000, a motorcycle accident knocked her 20 feet into the air.
I can remember every second of it, and it was really sort of rapturous.
She'd been riding to Las Vegas with a group of friends that included Jeremy Irons and Dennis Hopper.
You were badly hurt.
Oh, I was dead. And I wasn't breathing at all. Those boys saved me. My gang, my guys saved my life. My wingmen.
Yeah.
Don't make me start crying.
But the cover girl came back from that, too. Lauren Hutton has never regretted an adventure.
I was not there to see myself on the stands. I was there to get the money to go see the world. I've had a great life. I've been very lucky.
I'm Mo Rocca. Thanks for listening. And please join us again next Sunday morning.
Some gifts are simply loved. The right one becomes part of who someone is. Schiffman's Jewelers. Extraordinary jewelry and timepieces in Greensboro and Winston-Salem.
Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Everyone be ready.
Boldly go one step closer to where it all began.
What we are about to do cannot be taken back.
Star Trek Strange New Worlds, new season now streaming on Paramount Plus.